4 million former slaves were searching for social equality and economic opportunity after the Civil War. And the Republican Party drafted and pushed for the ratification of the 14th and 15th Amendments. They were laws intended to fully and immediately integrate freed slaves into society. The laws passed Congress. But it would take decades for newly freed African Americans to be granted full equality under the law. So what went wrong? Legal historian Lawrence Goldstone says that the very individuals believed to have been looking out for the civil rights of us all, the sitting justices of the Supreme Court, were instrumental in stripping African Americans of equal rights. Lawrence is the author of the new book called Inherently Unequal, The Betrayal of Equal Rights by the Supreme Court, 1865 to 1903. Good morning, Lawrence. He's joining us from Connecticut.
Good morning, Sammy.
Great timing for this book. It's the very last day of Black History Month. Radical Republicans pushed these laws forward. So it looked like the whole of American society was going to change. What actually motivated them to do this?
Well, you have to understand that these radical Republicans were not like today's radical Republicans. These radical Republicans wanted to expand the federal government to integrate these 4 million newly freed slaves into society as a national moral obligation. Yet, by 1900, Black people couldn't vote. You had a series of Jim Crow laws. There were 1,000 lynchings in the decade before. And all of this happened because as case by case came before the Supreme Court, the justices, using a strict construction basis, took a very narrow view of the 14th Amendment and chipped away at the guarantees. So by 1900, all of those equal rights guarantees that had been written into these amendments had been rendered moot by the very people who were supposed to protect those rights.
You give very graphic examples of the chipping away by the Supreme Court. Give us one that you can sum up quite quickly.
Well, there was one case in which 250 armed white men besieged a small town in Louisiana that was guarded by 150 African Americans who were members of the Louisiana militia. The white men overwhelmed the Black defenders, took their weapons, and then proceeded to slaughter 100 of them. 100 of the white men were brought to trial in federal court. 3 were convicted, and the Supreme Court overturned that conviction on very narrow grounds. And one of the grounds that the Chief Justice cited was that there was no evidence that this crime was racially motivated.
Now, you don't have to be a scholar of law to enjoy your book. You write like the case histories are stories, they're thrillers, they're terrifying episodes that happened to much of the African-American community in the South. What was it about the Supreme Court justices that made them instigate some of the Jim Crow laws that happened, some of the behavior that was happening to Southern Black people at the time?
Well, first of all, thanks for the compliment. The justices were, in fact, representing American public opinion, or at least white public opinion at the time. What they did was simply interpret constitutional amendments. Justices can't declare a constitution amendment unconstitutional. It's in the Constitution. So they interpreted it in such a way as to erode these equal rights. Most white Americans didn't want to sit in theaters next to Black people or be in restaurants next to Black people. And the justices found contrivances in the law to allow these little limitations that, as they taken as a whole, completely destroyed the intent of these amendments.
When we elect justices, when justices are picked nowadays, they have personalities and they're picked because they have this kind of background or that kind of background. What can you tell us about the justices at the time? Were they racist? Is that too simplistic an explanation for what happened in the South?
Well, they were no more or less racist than most of white America. It was a different time. There was a movement called social Darwinism that was moving through the country, through the world, actually, the English-speaking world, which said that if you did well in society, it's because you deserve to. And if you did poorly, it's because you deserve to. Well, white people, by and large, were doing well, and Black people, by and large, were doing poorly. So many white people in America concluded that is because white people were more fit Herbert Spencer, who was a social Darwinist, coined the phrase survival of the fittest, not Charles Darwin. And they just concluded that these black people were simply less fit to function in a modern society than white people. And the last thing you would want to do is enact a bunch of progressive laws that would water down all of society by elevating an inferior group to a place where they shouldn't be. So the justices, and many of them were corporate lawyers during this period because it was a great rise of business, simply were reflecting the ongoing public opinion, and they were interpreting the law in a way as to satisfy what they thought as the needs of society, not the way the law was meant to be written.
Lawrence Goldstone, your history of the Supreme Court also seems to reflect a high degree of what's now called judicial activism, you know, on the part of the justices, using their interpretations to reflect what they see as the will of the people and not just their interpretations alone. There was a different kind of judicial activism in the 60s with Thurgood Marshall, right? So it seems like activism, even though it's a dirty word now, has played on both sides of this debate in America.
Well, Todd, I believe that every justice is an activist. The Constitution, which most people don't seem to realize, is a very vaguely drawn document. Article 3, which defines the judiciary, is very short and doesn't go into specifics at all. The Constitution doesn't, for example, say how many justices should be on the court. So what you have is every justice bringing his or her own personal point of view to interpret the Constitution. So activism, for me, is not something confined to one side of the political spectrum or another, but simply something that is necessary in our society to come to a consensus on what the Constitution actually means.
Lawrence Goldstone, author of Inherently Unequal, The Betrayal of Equal Rights by the Supreme Court, 1865 to 1903. You're on a radio program called The Takeaway. What's your takeaway for us?
Well, what I wanted in the major decisions, the two major decisions were the civil rights cases in Plessy versus Ferguson. The civil rights cases called the Civil Rights Act of 1875 unconstitutional, and Plessy versus Ferguson established separate but equal. And both of those were 8-1 decisions. The eight justices that voted to take away equal rights did it on the basis of a strict reading of the Constitution, strict construction, something we hear a lot about today. The one dissenter, who was the same in both cases, John Marshall Harlan, dissented on the basis of fundamental justice. He talked about what the nation should be. And now we have the same dichotomy in the court, where some justices believe that we should rule on the basis of fundamental justice, what kind of country we're supposed to have. And other justices are saying, no, I know what the Constitution means, and if it doesn't mean precisely what I say it means,
right. We
cannot rule in that direction.
Lawrence Goldstone, that's some takeaway. You have to read his book. It's fascinating and a great read. It sounds, if we're talking about it, that it could be legal and very technical, but it is beautiful reading and catches you up with a very, very important time of history. Lawrence Goldstone is author of Inherently Unequal, The Betrayal of Equal Rights by the Supreme Court, 1865 to 1903.
Well, throughout this morning and online, we've been keeping tabs on the latest unrest in Libya. Here is some of the latest. The UN Refugee Agency says almost 100,000 people have fled fighting in Libya, and now it's calling the situation a humanitarian emergency. Meanwhile, 30 miles west of the capital, opposition forces in the city of Zawiya say forces loyal to Gaddafi are gathering on the outskirts of the city. Follow along with our coverage by heading to thetakeaway.org. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Femi Okeh. We're sitting in for John and Celeste this morning. Take care.